Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward.
Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, the road to creativity, part of the Podmatch podcast network. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And one thing I truly love to hear about is when a fellow creative is in one field, and but at the same time is keeping themselves branching out into many others, and then decides to make the pivot into going in a totally different direction. And I'm really excited to have my guest, Matt Whitten, to talk about all the different twists and turns that he has made throughout his career as a writer. For over 20 years, he has written for such shows as House, Law and Order, for Pretty Little Liars. He has the feature film Drones under his belt. He has written various stage plays, and he has made the pivot into becoming a thriller novelist. And I'm really excited about this one because his speculative thriller, 51%, has just been launched out there. You can definitely get it wherever bookstores are. And by all means, definitely pick this up because it sounds like a really fascinating story. And I'm really thrilled to have Matt here to talk about it and also to talk about his history in writing in general. So it is my pleasure to introduce my guest this week, Matt Whitten. Matt, how are you, sir?
I'm great. Thank you, George. It's great to be here.
Yes, and thank you very much for being here as well. You are coming to us from overseas right now, so I am glad to hear that that the connection is holding up, and I'm just really excited about all the success that's been going on with you.
The launch of 51% has been incredibly exciting. I've never written speculative fiction before, so it was a new venture for me. It's a thriller, so I've done that before, so I know how to keep the pacing up like that. But to do the world building and introduce a whole new world is definitely a new challenge, which I very much enjoyed.
Yes, and what a world it is. It is a world where the corporations known as the Big Six syndicates control everything. And they not only control infrastructure, but they also control human beings. They own 51% of each human out there. Is that correct?
They own 51% of a lot of people. And the way it works is that in this world, it's set 20 years from now. I used to say 30 years, but after 1 year of Trump, I've decided it's closer than that. It's 20 years. It's a world where so much has been privatized. And mm-hmm. This has been happening for the last 40 years, but it keeps happening. In 20 years, there's no more public high schools anymore. There's private mm-hmm. high schools. So if you want to go to a high school, you might have to make a deal with a syndicate where you're going to say, okay, I'll give you 10% of my income after I graduate from high school and college for 10 years. And in return, you guys will pay for my high school. And the same with college. You want to go to college? Maybe you'll pay another 10%. And in some ways, this is like way better than student loans. I'm sure you have friends that, you know, are paying off their student loans.
I still am.
Into their 40s and 50s. It's a tough road. So in some mm-hmm. ways, it seems, it's a good idea. You just pay a percentage. And if you're not making much money, you don't have to worry that much. Anyway, in this world, there's not good health insurance. Like Obamacare is like a thing of the past. So if, God forbid, get a serious disease, maybe you have to give up another 20% of your income for the next 7 years to take care of that disease. And eventually, all these things build up. And some people wind up being 51% owned. And they're like indentured servants. And this is my metaphor for how, not only metaphor, but a reality for how corporations have been getting more and more power over us over the past 40 years. The big corporations, the Elon Musks of the world, the Amazons and the Metas of the world. And this is how it's going. So that's what the book is inspired by.
Wow. And it sounds a lot like everyone gets their own backroom deal. In a sense, just like everything is just, okay, this is going to happen if this happens. And it's very much like a whole lot of a whole lot of things that are happening now behind closed doors when it comes to mergers and acquisitions, or this company taking over this company or whatever. And
yes,
and everything is just exactly being taken place in the boardroom.
Exactly. And a lot of stuff that we actually see. So for instance, we see the fact that at this point, a lot of utility companies have been privatized, or the power in a lot of different states. And a lot of water has been taken over. It's been given to private companies. A lot of prisons, about 10% of prisons in the United States are privately owned. The post office has gotten worse and worse, and it's getting replaced by UPS and FedEx. And at some point, people are talking about privatizing the post office. People are talking about no more national parks. They'll be administered by companies. So all this stuff is happening. In my book, the police departments are privatized. Like the NYPD is now the NYPD Incorporated. Or the nickname is the NYP Dink. And that may sound a little implausible, but the truth is, in this country, we have twice as many, this is literally true, we have twice as many private policemen or private security guards as public policemen. And in a lot of cities, there are five times as many private policemen or security guards as public. So we're getting a world where if you want good protection, security, you have to pay for it yourself. For your shopping center, for your gated community, for your privileged college campus, all kinds of places, even for housing projects, are privately administered. 30, 40 years with government getting more and more gridlocked and useless in a way, and corporations taking over.
Yeah, exactly. And your mention of the current administration reminds me of the mock-up that was done of the UFC octagon set up on the White House lawn. And my own sci-fi sports trilogy deals with a company called the Gladiatorial Combat League. And their big thing is that they are a subsidiary of the United States Department of Sports and Entertainment. And so they have, I'm looking at the mock-up and I'm just like, damn, like they set that up. They established that in 2041 in my story. I'm behind the times. Like I need to I got to escalate this apparently.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's amazing how fast things are changing. But it was so hilarious when on the one hand, Trump is like, he's talking about killing everybody in Iran, and Vance is over there in Iran doing these high level negotiations and all this stuff. And who knows what'll be happening when this episode airs. And then at the same time, Trump is going out to a UFC fighting match.
Yeah, just saying, I'm doing my part.
That's right. He's just surrounded by blood and guts and people fighting. And meanwhile, he's thinking about, maybe I'll kill all these people in Iran. If you put that in a movie, it would be great. It would be awesome.
Oh, yeah.
So let me ask you one question about cyber sports. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I'll just give you my question about sports. So your books are sports set in the future. And in 51%, I was imagining that cyber sports stars are the new stars. And that's the biggest sport with cyber sports, cyber games.
Oh, interesting.
Like Madison Square Garden, which is now named after a corporation or whatever. It's the site for these huge matches that people watch and they go and they watch on the screens. Does that seem plausible to you? Or do you think we'll still watch flesh and blood sports figures as our main sports entertainment?
I think we're going to wind up seeing a good hybrid of both, because I love the idea of a cyber sports thing, because that is something that can easily be used as a training ground for those who actually want to get in the ring. And that is something that mine focuses on, is that what's the key to it is not so much of cyber sports personalities or anything. Like these guys are all getting in the ring, but the main thing that the public has a grip on is the rules. And so as the rules change, then different rights come and go along to accommodate for those rules. I'm not really spoiling too much because this is part of book one, and this is really, it's a major plot point here, but because the rules have changed in the Gladiatorial Combat League to allow blunt objects to be used in matches against opponents, then all of a sudden everyone who was on their unemployment home and health insurance gets canceled, because all that money that's going towards everyone else's health insurance, now it's got to go towards all these guys that are literally putting their lives in danger by getting in the ring and having something like a lead pipe getting hit on the head with them. They have an opponent across the ring with a lead pipe in their hands. And now all of a sudden, any sort of money that was going toward everyone else's health insurance now has to go towards this guy for his health care because he's being put in so much more danger.
Yeah. I love the idea of sports set in the future. I don't know about your book, but for me also, it was like finding the heroes. I feel like the theme of my book is that in every generation, we have terrible evil arising. Every generation has its own Hitler or Haman or Stalin or somebody. Every generation has somebody that we have to, and 51%, there's these reluctant heroes. There's these two New York City police detectives. And one of them in particular, she just wants to live her life. She just wants to do okay. She's pregnant. She's broke. Her fiance died. He was a NYPD Inc. officer who was killed. And she just wants to, she's 20% owned. And she's worried that she might be 51% owned if there's a problem with the baby that she has to pay for. And she just wants to give her baby a good life, have a good life herself. And she's just trying to get by. But she finds herself in this situation where she has to take a moral stand. That was a lot of fun to write the characters that might be involved in this world.
And speaking of characters, one thing that really grabbed my attention was the line in the breakdown of your book. You have your main characters as the detective and their partner, which is a crime marketing consultant. And that to me reminded me of one of my favorite throwaway lines in a film. And that was in the 1987 version of The Running Man, when right before the game show begins, and Schwarzenegger as Ben Richards is sitting backstage in his quarters getting ready to go out there. And a gentleman walks in and he goes, "Mr. Richards, I'm your court-appointed theatrical agent." That is like one of those perfect lines that immediately sets the tone for what it is that we're about to see. So that's exactly what I was thinking of when I saw that. A crime marketing consultant, like that is perfect.
Her job in this world, the NYPD Inc., if you want to solve a murder, if you're a homicide detective, as a private company, you got to make money for the corporation. So you got to raise the money yourself to solve the murder. So if somebody dies, you go to their relatives, you go to their neighbors, you go to their church, you crowdfund, you go on Kickstarter to try to raise money. So hopefully it's somebody that you can really raise money off of because they're really sympathetic in some way, or maybe whatever, there's a rich widow or widower that you can hit up. But that's the job of the crime marketing consultant. So there's one guy on the team, one person on the one partner who is the lead detective and one who is the lead crime marketer. And that's how they do it. And in the book, the murder victim is a young, poor immigrant woman. Yeah. And there's no way they're going to get money off of her murder. It's like they'll be lucky if they get $20 for a week's worth of work. They're just not going to get a lot of money from this. And so the crime marketing consultant says, "We got to move on. We can't work this case. I can't get paid $20 for a week. I'm pregnant. I'm broke. I've been living off of oatmeal and coffee for the past 3 weeks." Yeah. And which I can relate to her. "I'm sorry, you want to be a good person, but you got to take care of yourself and your baby." But the detective, her partner, he's old school. He's Michael Connelly character. He's like Bosch. And there's no victim too small. We got to save everybody. Or excuse me, we got to get justice for everybody. It's a battle between them. Yeah, that's the crime. That's the crime marketing. She does all kinds of crazy things. One of my favorite parts of the book is she finds out that the victim was like, it fed the stray cats in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So she makes a cute kitten video in order to raise money to solve the murder.
In a sense, it's almost like everyone likes to put out GoFundMe pages for families and everything. But it's almost like it's not GoFundMe, it's GoFundYou. So it's basically just like GoFundYou to get this crime solved so that way you can get some closure.
Absolutely. And it costs a lot of money to solve a crime, because if you want to get a search warrant from the judge, you got to pay the judge $300. And if you want to get the forensics people to do a good job, but like a fingerprint analyst is going to cost you a couple $100, and the ME isn't going to work for free. So you got to pay her too. Everything. This is a world just about money. That was the prime mover of my book. It's all about money. That's what it is.
Which is not unlike our current day, because my 9-to-5 job is working for an insurance agent. And everyone always asks whenever a claim is filed, whether or not their rates are going to go up. And it's hard to say when it's not their fault. If it is their fault, that's one thing, because yes, your rates are going to go up because you're putting you're basically like sacrificing your accident-free discount. You're allowing this surcharge to go on your record, and that's going to be on there for about 3 years, according to the insurance company that I work with. But if you're not at fault, then no, you're not going to lose your accident-free discount. No, you're not going to get a surcharge, but every claim costs money, and right. that money has to be retrieved in some way, shape, or form. Now, obviously, the majority of it, the vast majority, is going to go from the at-fault party, but at the same time, there is still the work that goes into filing the claim and investigating the claim and doing all the behind-the-scenes stuff. And so there's a whole lot of elements that go into every single claim. That's why we always say, if it's possible for you to do this, like to take care of this with the at-fault party directly, then do it. If it's a way that you can go through their insurance, do it by all means. Like we recommend that. Because we don't want you to risk getting any sort of rate adjustment like this.
Yeah, yeah. No, I remember vividly when I had a traffic ticket, and I guess mm-hmm. I got two within an 18-month period. And I remember I had to spend an extra $1,800 in insurance after mm-hmm. that. And, it was pretty frustrating. It was like I went 45 miles in a 35-mile zone, and I wound up getting hit with $1,800.
Oops. Yeah. So I'm curious to know, like, what about what I like to call the road to creativity? And that's that period in time when you're on this one road and then all of a sudden you experience something or meet someone, see something, and you're just like, oh, that's, I want to do that. I want my life to be like that. And then you hit the off ramp, you're merging into traffic, you're on a whole other course. What is it about writing itself that got you to where you are? Because your writing has gone through quite a few different formats. You've done television, you've done film, you've done plays, and now you're in prose. So what is it in general that got you into writing in the first place?
The short answer would be, I don't know. And the slightly longer answer would be that I started writing poetry when I was 6 years old about how my favorite baseball team, the Baltimore Orioles, were going to defeat the hated New York Yankees in the upcoming year. And then I didn't write much until I was in 10th grade. And in 10th grade, I had a crush on my drama teacher. Her name was Karen Kramer. And she suggested that I write a play. So I did. Ooh. And the play was done for the United Methodist Women's Group in town. Wow. And I got $10. I was hooked. Then I had an undiagnosed illness when I was 17. And I decided that if, God willing, I got better again, that I would remember that writing and reading were the things I loved most, and I keep doing them and keep focusing on them. And I did get better after about 2.5 months. And so I've held to writing ever since then, with one brief period where I applied to law school 1 year when I wasn't doing too well with the writing. And then as soon as I got into the law school with this huge scholarship, I think I was about 30 at the time or something. Mm-hmm. I got all these great things happening in the writing life. So I kept with that instead. But in any case, I started as a playwright, and I guess I was inspired by seeing the play The Fantastics when I was 6 years old. Mm. And I was just amazed at the way they changed from Act 1 to Act 2, from being – end of Act 1 was like this cheerful, wonderful thing with the sun rising and everything was beautiful. And then they started Act 2 with the sun was just going down and getting a little bit more – like darker, and just that one thing just changed everybody's moods, and just the magic of the way they changed that on the theater, I just thought was incredible. So I got into it then. Also, I saw Pirates of Penzance, and so I got into playwriting. Then when I was about, and I had success as a playwright, then when I was in my 30s, I think it would have been the late 30s, I think, I started to realize that the thing I liked most in life for entertainment was to have a cup of tea, put my feet up, and read a murder mystery. So I decided, how about if I try writing a murder mystery? And that was really my switch from playwriting into murder. I have written a couple plays since then. But mm-hmm. that was my switch from writing plays to writing murder mysteries. I just wanted to write what I loved.
Yeah.
So I wrote one and got published. And so I wrote four of them. And I would have kept doing it, except I had this call from this agent to basically started off my TV career. Some agent, he had seen a play of mine in LA. And anyway, so I wound up, I got a freelance episode of Law and Order. Mm-hmm. And then I got the call to come out to Los Angeles to write for TV. So we came out, took the family from a small town in upstate New York. We came to LA, and I wrote for TV for about 20 years, which is a lot of fun. But then a few years ago, I decided that, again, I wanted to write what I loved the most. And what I loved the most at that point was reading thrillers.
Yeah.
I decided to try my hand at reading thrillers, try my hand at writing thrillers, and wrote a couple of them. Excuse me. Wrote a couple of them, and then 51% is my third one.
Nice.
So I guess it's really just been motivated by following what I loved, except more in the case of TV, I guess it was motivated in general just by wanting money and excitement. But that's what motivated the novels more than anything.
And the shows that you wound up writing for, like Law and Order, House, like procedural dramas, what were those experiences like getting to delve into that? And how did those shows help influence your writing in thrillers? Because it must have reminded you that to try this instead of this.
Yeah, definitely. With books, people really skim a lot, and that's part of the reading experience. But on TV, you really don't want people to skim. You really want people just glued to your TV set. I know it's harder now because people have telephones that they can get on at the same time. But you really want people just gripped by the TV. You don't want them turning the channel at the half-hour mark to watch a sitcom. When I was doing it, that's the way it was. It's like you'd start watching at 9 o'clock, and if you weren't loving the show, then you'd watch a sitcom. You always wanted your ratings to go up at the half-hour mark. And if they went down, which I will proudly say never happened with me with any of my shows. But if they went down, then it was like, oh my God, people are leaving. And if it went up, it's, oh, not only you're keeping your audience, but the people that were watching the other sitcom, you know, from 9 to 9:30, now they're going to want to watch the end of your show, the last half of your show. Anyway, excellent. How it influenced my writing. Between the TV shows and the playwriting, with playwriting, you sit in the audience, and if somebody's bored, they cough or they shuffle in your chairs. And then you've messed up, essentially, or maybe the actors have, but I would always blame myself. But anyway, something's not working. And then you also see, on the other hand, if something's working, it's exciting. So it really has motivated me to, in my books, is to, I just never want to lose the audience's attention just for a second. I don't want to go off on these long descriptions. I don't want to go off on long riffs about something that happened 20 years ago if it's not completely relevant to what's happening now. I just want to keep it real at all points. So I would say that. And the other experience, that thing about TV writing that helps with novel writing is, especially if you're writing for a show that has commercials, but even if you aren't, you just want real peaks and rhythm of the show and excitement. So at the end of every act, when the commercial is about to start, you really want it to come to a crescendo. So I think it kept me thinking in terms of twists, would be another word for it. There'd often be a twist at the end of an act. So keeping wanting to have twists and be the thing. And then I'll tell you one more thing that I learned, because I think it's funny, because it sounds small, but it's humorously important, I believe, which is that, and I learned this when I worked on Law and Order, which is that whenever characters would go to a location to find A, they would never find A. So for instance, if Briscoe and Green, the two cops, if they go to a bar to see if Joe was there on the night of the murder, it's like they ask the bartender, was Joe here the night of the murder? And if Joe says, yeah, he was, that's like a boring scene. You go somewhere and you find out what you expect. But if they go to the bar and the bartender says, no, Joe wasn't here that night. And then as the audience or as Briscoe and Green, you get depressed for a second. But then the bartender says, but Joe's wife was here. And it's, oh my God, Joe's wife. So she's a suspect. So now we go in a whole different direction in our next scene. And that's why when people would watch Law and Order, they'd go, oh my God, there's so many twists. It's so fast moving. It's so cool. And that simple thing was like the basis for it being exciting. And I think about that with everything. I think about, say, my character is going to a girl's house and hoping he'll get a kiss or whatever. Instead, he'll get a slap, or instead, he'll get a lot more than a kiss or something. It's just going to be different. It's not going to be what he expected. Anyway, that's another thing I learned from TV.
Nice. And then, so you're getting all this work out there. And then you go ahead and make that transition into writing prose. And when you're doing that, you said that 51% is the third. novel that you've done so far.
Third thriller, yeah. Like back in the day, I wrote The Four Mysteries. But since I'm like Rip Van Winkle, I quit writing novels for 20 years while I was doing TV. But since I woke up from my Rip Van Winkle TV, this is my third novel, yeah.
Nice. And then, but 51%, that's the one that's been chosen as the one that's going to represent you out there at first. Are there any plans at all for the previous two books to come out?
Oh, they've come out already. The Necklace came out 4 years ago. Yeah, The Necklace came out about 4 years ago, and Killer Story came out a couple of years ago.
Wonderful. So things are really picking up right now because you have a whole lot of different work that's out there. But at the same time, there are certain things that take place that you never get bored of, you never get tired of. And that's the wonderful parts that come with being a published author. One thing I always love to ask about is that after all the work has been done, you got the story done, you put in the work to get all the chapters written, you have your publisher, they're on board, they've gone through the editing, they've gone through the formatting, they've gone through the cover design. The cover design looks awesome, by the way. I think that looks really cool.
Thank you. I'm really happy with it too.
And then there's that wonderful moment where after all that work is done, there's a package at your door and it's your chance to finally hold the copy of the finished novel in your hands. What was that experience like for you for this?
I can't describe how wonderful it is. You open up that box. First, you open up the box and you get like the advanced reading copy. And that's always amazing. Just to hold it in your hands and to feel it and look through it. You open the book to a random page and you go, oh my God, I remember writing that page. I remember writing that sentence. I remember trying to figure out how to write that sentence the best and laboring over that sentence. It's an incredible feeling. And when that's the advanced reading copy. And I don't know, I get the same feeling again when I get the full-on copy that's going to be in the stores and everything. It's amazing.
It really is. It's a feeling that just never goes away. No matter how many books you've published, no matter how many stories that you've written, no matter how ingrained in this wonderful world of writing that you are, getting that finished copy just means the world. And it always will. So what are your plans next for this? Like, you've already had the experience as a television writer, as a screenwriter, as a playwright, now as a novelist. How do you feel about continuing on in this field as a novelist?
I'm excited about it. I'm writing. I should say, by the way, that 51%, I was also hired by NBC to co-write pilot adaptation. So it's
no
it's,
kidding.
Yep. So it's possible that will also be a TV show. We'll see. But anyway, it's been exciting to work on. As a novelist, I'm always doing different things. And my next novel is called The Men's Group. And it's about a group of men that meet every Sunday for breakfast at a local joint. And they're a very varied group of men. They range in age from their 20s to their 70s. One guy has been living in a van for the last 3 years. He's a carpenter. Another guy just got married for the first time at the age of 72. And he's trying to figure out, like, if his marriage is normal, like he's never been married before. So he's always asking his friends, is it okay if my wife and I, we fight like this? Is that normal? Is it okay? And he's real sweet. It's all very normal, but he just doesn't know. And there's another guy who's a TV writer. Anyway, one of them gets murdered and the cops think that, oh, I should have said, these guys are all members of AA. They're all sober, anywhere from 20 years to 9 months. And so one of them dies of ketamine and the cops think it's an overdose and they all think it's murder. And they're going to find out who killed their friend. So that's the story. It's inspired by my own experiences going to an AA men's group for the last 20 years. We would meet at a restaurant in Pacific Palisades every Sunday, which unfortunately burned down last year, along with my house and about 7,000 other houses. So the book is from the heart. It's my poem, my elegy or something to the place and to the guys, because we've scattered now. I moved to upstate New York and another friend went to Idlewild and another friend went up to Washington State. So that group is gone a little bit. But anyway, so that's what the book's about. For some reason, I just do different kinds of things. Like I did this speculative thriller, 51%, which is that's pretty gritty. It's pretty hardcore. It's funny, too, actually. All my stuff has humor. Like in Law and Order, people always knew my Law and Order episodes because they were the one that had the most jokes.
Nice.
But it's a gritty story. And then this the Meds Group, but talks about serious topics like recovery from addiction and male friendship and male loneliness, the epidemic of loneliness in the country. But it's also like a kind of a light mystery. So anyway, I don't know, for whatever reason, I just try different things all the time.
Very cool. Very cool. And for those that are just kind of like getting started in this, in their own field, whether it's trying to get in, trying to break into television writing, whether it's trying to get a screenplay going, whether it's writing their play or writing the book for the first time, whatever it is, they definitely are putting in the work, but they're not sure exactly what to do for that next step. What is it that you would recommend that they do?
I'll tell you a story that happened with me. When my wife was pregnant with our first child, I was trying to write this screenplay that I thought would be like real commercial. It was called The President's Daughter. And I don't remember, it was some kind of crime, thriller, murder thing. But somehow, I don't know, my heart wasn't quite in it. What I really wanted to write was a one-man play about a homeless Native American man that I met on the streets of Brooklyn, who just had a really interesting life story. To my wife, and we had no money at the time. We were totally broke. Yeah. I said, Nancy, I feel bad. You're pregnant and we have no money. And there's no way that I should be writing this one man play. I really have to make this movie work, this President's Daughter. And I'm going to do that. And my wife said, she said, no, write the one man show. I said, really? You're pregnant. We're broke. I can't do that. That's ridiculous. And she said, no, it's what you should do. It's what you want to do. And essentially follow your heart. So I followed my heart. I wrote this one-person play, which, I mean, who goes to see one-man show? Especially back then, it was less popular, that form. And so the play wound up actually being done many places in the United States. It was successful and was also very meaningful in my life because a lot of people saw that show who were Native American or who were non-traditional theater audiences, who were struggling with addiction themselves or were poor. It's just not the people you usually find going to some fancy theater. But they went to the theater and it was really good. He came to see the show in New York City and he loved it. It was like the biggest experience of his life. He went every single night. It had an 8-week run. He went every single night and he just loved it. He just basked. So, and the actor who performed it, I'm sorry to say he passed away about 15 years ago, but it was like the biggest thing of his life, or at least that's in his memorial service. That's what people said. It's like really hard if you're a Native American actor, and maybe it's easier now, but it's probably still hard to get work and to get a good role. And so this was like the best role of his life, and he threw his heart and soul into it. And so it was like huge for him. So like all these things happened just because I followed my heart. I wrote this successful play that got a lot of attention. It was really meaningful in some other people's lives. Okay, now look what would have happened if I had done the other thing. If I had just written The President's Daughter, it would have been a crappy screenplay. Nobody would have produced it. It wouldn't have fed anything in my soul or anybody else's soul. And it wouldn't have made any money anyway. Because any time I try to write something just to make money, it don't work. So that's a long way of saying follow your heart. And the reason I tell that story is just, I could just say follow your heart, but I just want to put where it comes from me, that I really believe that with all my soul, is that as a writer, you just have to do that. You have to follow your heart.
And you got like a full on success story because of that, because you had the opportunity to either chase something that you felt would bring in some more money, or something that you believed with all your heart that you needed to write and get out there. And you were rewarded because you chose your soul like over commerce.
And yes, and I was rewarded in ways I could not have anticipated, not only financially, but in other ways I could never have anticipated.
So with all of this, everything that you have going on and everything that's continuing forward, where can my listeners find you on social media to keep in touch with you?
On Instagram, I'm MattWhitten22, and my website is MattWhittenWriter.com.
Excellent.
And those are probably the best two ways to find me.
Excellent. And I can't wait to have you back on here to talk even more about your history in writing. Cause I think that you have a lot of fascinating stories to tell, and I'm really excited to get to know them. And I wish 51% the best of all the best. And I'm excited to see what happens with that. And I hope that all of you who are out there are feeling just as inspired to do exactly what Matt did. Follow your heart. As Campbell said, follow your bliss and and see where that takes you. Because if you're doing something just to chase a trend, guess what? You're too late already. The trend is already passed. So you need to go ahead and focus on something that you want to tell, the story that is gnawing at your soul to get out there. And because that is what needs to be done. In these crazy times, we need your stories, your visions, and your ideas now more than ever. So for Matt Whitten, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward, and I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to he'sgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to George@he'sgotit.com.